When Australia emerged from World War I and the Great Depression, it yearned for a prosperous future built on a strong identity. But what was the Australian identity and how best to protect it? Some, like the composer of this music, Clive Douglas, looked for a homegrown identity, while others in the arts, politics and religion looked further afield to Hitler's Germany for inspiration. Hello, I'm Rachel Kahn. Welcome to Nazi Dreams and Realities on the Spirit of Things, here on RN. I'm Rachel Kahn. While historian David Bird will take us down the dark road of Nazi dreaming in Australia later in the program, first, Sydney-based filmmaker Rod Friedman leads us on a slightly brighter path to reconciliation in the heart of Nazi Europe. Rod Friedman grew up in Australia, but his Jewish forebears were from Lithuania. Many of them emigrated in the 1930s, but his great uncle Hetzkel remained. Friedman made a film about him and the fate of the Jews of the town of Jagare. In July of this year, Jagare was the site of an unusual commemoration, initiated by a local Lithuanian who'd seen Rod's film. This is a story about new dreams of reconciliation. Well, Rod, a dozen years ago now, you made a film that received a lot of attention and some awards. It was shown in all the film festivals around the world, Uncle Hetzkel, about your great uncle in Lithuania. When you met him, he was 93. Now, just how fortunate would he have been to have survived as a Jew in Lithuania?
Rachel, it was an extraordinary story, and my encounter with him was very fortunate. He was one of 6% of Lithuanian Jews who survived the Holocaust. It's a figure which is quite shocking, because even in Germany, if you were a German Jew, your chances of survival were higher than if you were in Lithuania. So he survived the war. Extraordinarily, his wife survived, but his parents were victims of the Holocaust, and his children were as well.
Well, he was actually saved by a kind landlord.
It was in the hiatus when the Russians had left, and the Germans had not quite arrived, and the Lithuanian militia were on the loose. These were nationalist, fascist groups, and some of them came to his house one day to take him, and his landlord intervened and said that he shouldn't be taken because he had been a student of a particular linguist named Jablonskis, and my great uncle was a lexicographer and a linguist. But these militia came a second time, and his landlord intervened again and produced a document from his pocket which had a signature of the local commander, and he showed it to these militia and said that this man is not to be taken. Here's the signature of your commandant, and he's not to be taken prisoner. And it turned out that that piece of paper which he pulled from his pocket had nothing to do with it. It was merely a receipt for some left luggage that previous tenants had left there. So this man was risking his life, and my great uncle was saved by this non-Jewish man, and went on to go through all sorts of escapades, but his life was saved on other occasions by, what can I say, human kindness in these extraordinary circumstances of living through the Kovno ghetto and later on in Dachau, and finally being freed at the end of the war.
Well, he was certainly one of the few, as you say. When you went back to the town, Jagare, where he lived, where your great-grandparents also lived and had a cloth-dyeing factory, you met a man named Isaac Mendelssohn, who told you what actually happened to the Jews of Jagare.
Yes, Isaac Mendelssohn was known to many people who returned to that part of Lithuania, right in the very north on the border of Latvia. He was known as the last Jew in Jagare because he had survived having been in the Red Army during the war. He'd fled literally hours before the Germans and the Lithuanian collaborators arrived to round up the Jews. So whilst he wasn't an eyewitness, he came back immediately after the war and heard the story from the local people. What had happened, in essence, was the story which was repeated all over in some 250 sites all over Lithuania, where the Lithuanian nationalist collaborators moved in, sometimes organized by the Germans, but often not, and rounded up the Jews, put them into ghettos, and in most cases then most of the local population were executed. So in Žagare, where my great-grandparents, Avraham and Rocha Lemchen, lived, there was a ghetto for a matter of probably 6 or 8 weeks, and people were intensely humiliated. You know, the rabbis were publicly humiliated. There were extraordinary tactics which were used. For instance, they would ask for 50 strong men to be volunteers to carry out some work, and people would put their hands up or they would be forced to volunteer, and they were taken to the edge of town and executed. In the same way, they sometimes asked for leaders of the community to come forward for a particular reason and executed them. So in this way, the community lost its leadership, lost its strength, and was totally confused and demoralized. Then what happened was on October the 2nd, 1941, which was Yom Kippur, the holiest day of the Jewish calendar, the Jews were rounded up in the town square of Žagare, and they were told that they would be sent to work. And then at a given signal from a German who was on a balcony, hidden machine gunners opened fire. In fact, the details of the Einsatzgruppen reports, which was the German killing squads, notes that there was an uprising and there was something of a rebellion. And some of the Jews attacked these partisans, these so-called Lithuanian partisans. Some of them were killed and some of them were wounded. So the killings then stopped and the rest of the survivors were taken out to the outskirts of town, a place called Narishkin Park. And their pits had already been prepared and they were told to strip and stand on the edge of these pits, and they were executed. And layer after layer of people were thrown into the pits, and lime was put over one lot, and then the next lot were executed. And there are some discrepancy in the numbers. Some say 3,000, and some say up to 6,000 people were killed there. And this was related to me by Isaac Mendelssohn, and it's also written about in a book called Last Walk in Narishkin Park by an Australian author, Rose Swee. And she did extraordinary research at Yad Vashem and found eyewitness accounts. So Isaac Mendelssohn's account, even though he wasn't there, has been corroborated by other recorded statements from eyewitnesses and one survivor. There's allegedly just one survivor from that massacre.
Well, that book by Rose Swee was read by a young Lithuanian who was unaware of the history of his town, Žagare.
Yes, recently this year I was contacted by a young Lithuanian man, Valdas Balčiūnas. He's about 35 years old, born and bred in Žagare, in this northern town. And he contacted me with the idea of erecting a memorial, a commemoration in the town square. Not just me, but other descendants, Jewish descendants of Žagare. And it turned out that the turning point for him, he had been completely ignorant of these details of the history in his town until he read this book, Last Walk in Narishkin Park, and he was completely shocked to find out not only that there had been a significant Jewish population in the town, at one point some 60% of the town had been Jewish earlier last century, but the manner in which they had died. And he was so overcome by the events that he just felt that he had to do something about this. And he decided that the presence of the Jews in the town and the way that they had died, and also the fact, most significantly, the fact that there had been Lithuanian collaborators who had been responsible for their deaths, should be commemorated. And he decided that there should be a plaque in the centre of the town, which was also significant.
Can I ask you, Rod, to read a bit from the letter that he wrote you? Because I think it contains a lot of his very profound feelings about this subject.
Certainly. When I was first contacted by Valdas to ask whether I would be interested to come to this commemoration, I thought it's a long way to go, and it seemed rather difficult. But I did want to send him the film that I had made, Uncle Chatzkel, because it had the eyewitness account from Isaac Mendelssohn about what had happened in Zhagare and had other footage concerning the town. So I sent him the film, and he wrote back to me, and part of what he wrote was, I'll read it from it now. Dear Mr. Rod, first of all, thank you very much for the Uncle Chatzkel film, an amazing story. I'm 35 this year. I was born and grew up there in Zhagare by the Naryshkin Park. Only after Lithuania got its independence back, people started to talk a bit about the Jewish tragedy. First of all, there were graves where one day the plaques changed from Soviet citizens into Jewish victims. And that's referring to the fact that during the Soviet era, there were these memorials, but they said, here lie 3,000 Soviet citizens, here lie 6,000 Soviet citizens. They were never called Jewish victims. He says, Valdas continues, as I grew bigger, I started hearing the stories, studied more history, and read The Last Walk in Naryshkin Park. From then I started to understand what history holds in our small town. I have the only grandmother who is 84 this summer, and she remembers a lot from her childhood. When asked, she started to talk about the Jewish tragedy, about the Lithuanian collaborants and the killings. My initiative to unveil the plaque is a small step forward to explain to the locals the truth. I do not want my children to grow in the world of lies. I do not want the future of the town to be built on a curved foundation. A dozen of locals were collaborants, a few names I know. Many people had worked in Jewish craft shops. Many Lithuanians lived, or still live, in Jewish houses. All the Lithuanian community, in one way or the other, benefited over taking the property. That is probably why people did not want to hear the story, and that is why I'm even more willing to tell it. The Soviet generation I do not have any hopes for. My target is my generation and the younger. The more I talk, the more response and understanding I get from others, and I slowly achieve small results. Therefore, I need all information about the past. Like your uncle, it's fragile and it's disappearing. You have to catch every word and every story you can grasp. I am ready to listen and record and pass it over to others. The Jewish spirit is alive, and I, my family, want to make it stronger. If there is a way to do something to ease the pain. Therefore, from now, even though I know Zhagare will remain the sad recollection for Jews, may I once again call it your home. Sad, still bleeding, but the roots, like you said in the film, are such, and they are priceless. You and family are welcome back to visit, stay, remember. We're slowly building new Zhagare, and you can again be part of it in all possible ways. Like Mrs. Rose Zwie said, may there be more walks in the Naryshkin Park. With heartiest wishes, Valdas Balčiūnas.
Gosh, Rod, you just wonder where that goodness and that sensitivity and sympathy, the empathy, comes from.
I was completely overcome when I received that letter, and of course I determined immediately that I needed to go to Lithuania to participate in this commemoration event, which took place in July this year.
Rod Friedman is an independent filmmaker in Australia. His documentary, Uncle Chatzkel, is available from the National Film and Sound Archive. You can find a link to it by going to abc.net.au/radionational and scroll down to The Spirit of Things. And while you're there, you can also see a photo of the memorial to the Jews of Zhagare. Rod Friedman with a few other international guests were there for the unveiling in July of this year.
Rachel, it was extraordinary in that looking back on it, it felt more like a week than a couple of days. There were a number of descendants, 8 or 9 from Israel, from Australia, myself and Rose, we were there, from the UK and from the US. We arrived a day or so before. On the Friday, we went out to Narishkin Park to go to the site of the massacre. Each of us had family there.
It's quite chilling. May I just intervene there? Because those pits are now flower beds. It's a strange juxtaposition.
It's an extraordinarily beautiful and terrifying place at the same time. And that's the juxtaposition for me that in Lithuania is just riddled with these places of extraordinary beauty until you know what took place. And these massacre sites are, as I said, some 250 all over the country. Narishkin Park is part of an estate. There was a Count Narishkin who was a wealthy Lithuanian. I think he may have been Polish or Russian background. There's a large palace. It's a very large mansion. There are stables. It's a center for equestrian events. And just on the edge of this is this heavily treed space and a U-shape of what looks like flower beds, but is in fact the execution pits, which were planted with flowers. And the scale of it is just overwhelming. You can imagine a U with each of the three sides of it being about 100 metres, 70 or 80 metres. And knowing that somewhere in there my great-grandparents are buried is something which changed me, I think, the first time I went there. It's one thing to read about the Holocaust and the events, but it's something else to stand on that ground and feel the echoes of that history.
Tell me, what did happen then on the day of the commemoration?
What happened was there was a gathering in the town square, and I just want to make a point that there are memorials and there are plaques in these different towns in Lithuania, but they are almost, without exception, outside of the town in these places of execution, which took place in forests and usually outside of the town. So that history and that commemoration is hidden from today's population. But Valdis decided that he would put this plaque in three languages, in Lithuanian, in Yiddish, and in English, right in the town square, which had been surrounded by Jewish shops up to the time of the war. And that was a very deliberate step so that people would confront it, would perhaps go up to it and look at it with curiosity and discover for themselves what had happened there. So there were some, probably 150 to 200 people there. There were representatives from local government. There was a letter which was read out from the foreign minister of Lithuania. There was a letter from the local member of parliament. The sort of equivalent of our mayor stood up and expressed his sorrow for the events of the past and his support for this project, and saying that young people should learn their history and should remember. There was a series of speeches, one from the son of Isaac Mendelssohn, who had been the last Jew in Jagare and died last year. His son talked about how significant this event would have been for Isaac had he lived. There was a man who was a child of somebody who had been saved by Lithuanians. Earlier that day, Valdas had taken us to meet people who had been children at the time of the Holocaust, but their parents had saved Jews in Jagari. Now, that was something that I hadn't known about, and I felt enormously kind of buoyed by that knowledge that whilst there were the collaborators who had participated in the killings, there were also people who risked their lives and the lives of their families to save Jews. So he spoke at the ceremony. A number of people who were descendants spoke about what it meant to them to be invited back. to not feel so much that it was only a place of death, but the fact that history had been acknowledged publicly and openly was of enormous significance to us who were descendants of the survivors. During the ceremony, it was very atmospheric at seemingly significant parts of the ceremony. These dark purple rolling clouds just filled the sky, and at one point there was this extraordinary cloudburst and people scattered for 3 or 4 minutes and then came back. And at the climax of the events, when the wording on the plaque was read out, the clouds just rolled away and the sky turned blue, bright blue, and the sun came out and the umbrellas came down and people just regathered. And it was a chilling moment and a really uplifting moment when a man called Professor David Katz intoned the mourner's Kaddish in Yiddish and sang out at the top of his voice in the town square where our forebears had been massacred. And this Yiddish voice resonated through the square. And for Valdas, he said to me afterwards that this was the moment for him when it all came together and he felt that all his efforts had been worthwhile. So that for me was also a great privilege to have been standing there, because I never imagined myself participating in some kind of event about reconciliation. It always seems to be somebody else's story, and yet I found myself in the midst of this truly reconciling event. It reads as follows. For hundreds of years, Zhagare, in Yiddish Zhage, had been home to a vibrant Jewish community. Zhage's marketplace had many Jewish shops and was a center of commerce for merchants from here and a range of other towns. Many of their shops surrounded this square. Zhage was also famous for its many Hebrew scholars, the learned of Zhage. German military occupiers and their Lithuanian collaborators brought the region's Jewish men, women, and children to this square on October 2, 1941. Shooting and killing of the entire Jewish community of Zhage began here and continued in the forests nearby. About 3,000 Jewish citizens were killed. The thing that's particularly significant for me there is that it mentions the Lithuanian collaborators, because the Lithuanian government and one might say society as a whole is undergoing a transformation from having left the Soviet domination of nearly 50 years. And in a sense, over the last 20 years, they've been able to write their own history, which up until now was written for them by the Russians. So Jews weren't mentioned. The Lithuanian suffering under the Germans was mentioned, but they were called Soviet citizens. The Lithuanian suffering under the Soviet occupation, when many were exiled to Siberia, wasn't mentioned. And so they are well and truly writing their own history, and rightly so. However, in the rewriting of history, there are certain facts which tend to be left out. And one of those is the role of Lithuanians in the massacres of the Jews. And in my readings, it's almost unprecedented in other countries, in France, Hungary, Czechoslovakia. You don't get these extraordinary numbers of local people participating in the killings of the Jews before the Germans even took part. So the fact that this plaque mentions that it was German military occupiers and their Lithuanian collaborators is significant, because it's telling what is regarded by most historians outside of Lithuania as telling the truth of history and not trying to fudge it. I think what's behind it is that Lithuania wants to see itself as a victim of the Germans and a victim of the Soviets, and certainly that was the case to a terrible extent. And the stories are horrific of suffering there, whether you're Jewish or not Jewish. But in my view, it's very important to tell the whole truth and not to be selective about it. So I think Valdas's courage and the local people who supported his initiative to have this commemoration plaque to be applauded.
Can I ask you one final question? And it's going back to your uncle Chatzkel. He said to you when you saw him a dozen years ago, tears in his eyes, "I am completely without family here." Why do you think he stayed?
Why did he stay? I think there are a number of reasons. I think the first was that when he was in the Kovno ghetto, they had from time to time, the Germans had what they called Kinderaktions. The children were literally rounded up and taken away. He had two children, Victor and Azaria, who were aged 11 or 12 and 8 years old. He and his wife were out at work at forced labour and came home to find that the children had been taken. They never really knew what happened to the two boys. Some say that they were taken to Auschwitz, but I've researched and he researched and there's no record of them there. All around Kovno there were a number of forts where people were taken and massacred, and one in particular called the Ninth Fort. The children may have been just taken locally and killed there, but he and his wife, who were reunited after the war, never knew what happened to the children. And I feel that when they returned, after both being sent to different concentration camps, they lived in hope that the children may have been saved, they may have been saved by a non-Jewish family, they may have survived somehow. And then at a certain point, it became too hard to leave. The Russians had clamped down on everybody. I think there's another reason, which is that he was a Lithuanian language specialist. He wrote the first Lithuanian-Russian dictionary. He was a lexicographer, a writer of dictionaries. He went on, strangely, in later decades to be given awards by the Soviets for his work and regarded as a great scientist. And so, working in that milieu of Lithuanian language, he said to me that he'd had invitations to go to Israel, to go to the United States. He knew that there was family in Australia. But he wondered what he would have done as a Lithuanian language specialist in other parts of the world. And so he stayed. And so for us it was an extraordinary gift for my family to being able to meet this literally the last leaf on our Eastern European family tree.
Well, your film, Uncle Chatzkel, is certainly a great gift to us, and it's wonderful that it has generated this reconciliation a dozen years later. Rod Friedman, it's been great having you on The Spirit of Things. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Rachel.
Rod Friedman is an independent filmmaker based in Sydney, and he told me that after the memorial service in the town square of Žagarė, he sat astonished as a band of Lithuanian musicians played traditional Jewish klezmer music. Recent visitors to Australia, the London Klezmer Quartet, with their new album. Klezmer music would have been unheard of to Australians in the 1920s and 30s, who generally preferred their Jews to be of a British caste and culture, like the Third Chief Justice and Ninth Governor General of Australia, Sir Isaac Isaacs. But even attitudes to Britain were ambivalent after the calamity of World War I, and a strong, uniquely Australian identity was yearned for. Composers, writers, and political dreamers were all looking for it. Melbourne-based historian David Bird has closely examined this period and discovered a stream of Aussie nationalists who were inspired by Nazism. His book is Nazi Dreamtime. Well, David, I was fascinated by your book, Nazi Dreamtime, Australian Enthusiasts for Hitler's Germany. But I must say that when I mentioned it to people, they immediately said, oh, no, surely they were very few and far between, nothing to worry about. But clearly, you and others have looked at this phenomenon and seen something much more than just a bunch of marginal cranks.
Indeed. Now, the numbers may have been rather small, but I too was surprised by the influence that these people exercised in the 1930s and by the widespread dissemination of their points of view. I came to the topic through reading a history of British enthusiasts for Nazi Germany. Always on the search for new topics, of course, I wondered to myself if perhaps there was an Australian chapter of this story to be told. And I noted that one of the characters being discussed in the British history was, in fact, unknown to that author, was a Tasmanian, C.E. Carroll. And that, of course, put me then onto the idea, well, perhaps there is an Australian version of this story, and indeed, as you know, there certainly is. Perhaps these people were not quite as numerous as those in Britain, and they were obviously more detached, but nevertheless, it's one part of our Australian story that has been largely ignored, and it's something that may perhaps help to qualify the Anzac myth a little as we're coming into the centenary of that period.
Yes. Well, how widely spread across the classes and types of Aussies was this fascination with the Führer and Il Duce?
Well, I think you'll find that it spreads across all classes. The exceptionally wealthy, those born with silver spoons in their mouths, and those who have made their own wealth, right down to virtually permanently unemployed labourers who joined this movement as street fighters, former communists. A great bulk of them, I suppose you could probably say, were middle class, lower middle class. There are, of course, as you know, many who love to categorise political activists by their class. Most political activists probably are middle, lower middle class. One of them, P.R. Stevenson, of course, referred to himself as a member of the little bourgeoisie. Without any attempt to be derogatory. But it really does attract people of all classes and even quite a few women, which, of course, is quite surprising given the misogyny of the essential ideology of Nazism.
Yes, quite interestingly, Adela Pankhurst Walsh, a suffragette turned fellow traveller.
She's probably one of the better-known members of this movement. Now, as you know, she was the daughter of Mrs. Pankhurst and active in the suffragette movement. Now, for some reason, she undertook self-exile into Australia in the early years of the 20th century. She was a very volatile woman, to say the least. And she and her husband, Tom Walsh, who was a member of one of the founders or prominent members of the Seamen's Union, were amongst the founding members of the Communist Party of Australia in 1920, I think it was. So she was very much a radical activist. But by the mid to late 20s, she did a U-turn and had become an imperialist. And she spends most of the 1930s as a member of the Empire Guild of Women, advocating British imperialism and, you know, the tightening of the ties of the empire and very much a monarchist and so on. But by the late 30s, she's shifted again over towards the extreme right and looking very favourably at something like Nazism and arguing that there's no reason for Britain and Germany to be involved in any future conflict.
Well, what do you think drew the more mainstream person like Robert Menzies to Hitler's Germany?
Robert Menzies, of course, is the most public of the people that I've discussed. Menzies had an interest in, when he was a member of the Young Nationalists in Victoria in the early 30s, the Young Nationalist movement had a little fascist clique in there headed by, I think, Wilfred Kent Hughes, who was later a Victorian politician and federal politician in the 1950s. And they would discuss at their conferences the achievements, as they saw them, of Mussolini's Italy. Someone like Kent Hughes was keen to reproduce this social movement in Australia. He said that I want a fascist movement in Australia, fascism without coloured shirts, if that's possible. Now, Menzies was wise enough, politically prudent enough to say at these early Young Nationalist conferences that, yes, I can see the benefits that Mussolini has brought to Italy, but these methods are not applicable to Australia. When he became a federal politician, of course, he's in the Lyons, senior member of the Lyons government, and the thing that stamps the Lyons government, of course, is appeasement. All of these senior ministers in the Lyons government want to go to Europe and meet Hitler. Lyons himself had an interview lined up with Hitler in June 1935, but Hitler pulled the plug for some unexplained reason at the last minute, and Dame Enid, as she later was, bore a grudge over this one and said that they took it personally. But Menzies is in there as well. He's spending quite lengthy periods in Britain at the time, and he wants to go to Germany just because it is the focus of that particular decade, the devil's decade, as people tended to call it. So he goes to Germany in August 1938. In his own words, he said, "I'm prepared to give Hitler the benefit of the doubt, and I'll draw my conclusions after I've been to Germany myself." Well, he did so. He spent several weeks there in August 38 and was extremely impressed by what he saw. This is not a particularly new observation, but I think what I've done is just drawn it in a little bit more detail of just how singularly impressed Menzies was. Now, what was he impressed with? The material achievements of the new Germany.
Yes, but wasn't he also impressed by the willingness of the Germans,
yes,
to
what he calls the
devote themselves, yes, to the spiritual cause.
Now, in all of Menzies' travels throughout Europe and America in this pre-war period, he always draws analogies between the conditions that he observed in America or Holland or Germany, Britain, and conditions at home. What impresses him about Germany is the spirituality and the unselfish attitude that the average German seems to have adopted, according to his observations. A less material outlook on life, an outlook where they're prepared to make sacrifices on behalf of the nation. Now, when he came back to Britain in September 38 and then back to Australia in the same month, he gave a number of interviews where he was quite unashamedly expressed his favourable views of what he'd seen of Nazism. And October 1938, he made a public speech in Sydney where he drew a contrast between the quality of the leadership in Australia, that is Lyons, and the quality of leadership that he'd seen in Germany, that is Hitler. And now, of course, this is often taken as, oh, it was all just an attempt to remove Lyons from the leadership because there was tension between the two men at the time, which it was, but I've given Menzies credit for believing in what he said. And that speech of October 1938 was quoted ad nauseam by these Nazi enthusiasts for years afterwards as an example of look, even Mr. Menzies can see the great achievements that Hitler has made.
Well, you've mentioned P.R. Stevenson, also known as Inky Stevenson, and he's an example of someone who had come from a more communist leaning toward National Socialism under the banner of the Publicist, which he and William J. Miles edited together. Just how important was the Publicist for these Nazi dreamers?
Well, Stevenson, of course, is a fascinating case study, another ex-communist, as you say, not a founder of the Communist Party, but a communist as a Rhodes Scholar at Oxford, and throughout the 1920s. Now, he returned to Australia in 1932. He'd been involved in publishing in London in the late 20s, along with Jack Lindsay, one of the sons of our friend Norman. So when Stevenson returns to Australia in September 32 to establish a press, he's still regarded by the security services as a communist, but he's, to my mind, he's looking for something else. Now, this, of course, is at the height of the Great Depression, and like many intellectuals, he's looking for alternatives. And he meets W.J. Miles, who is very impressed with a literary magazine that Stevenson established in 1935, only one issue, unfortunately, for him. And Miles is prepared to fund this monthly journal, The Publicist, which they established together in July 1936. Now, this journal became the mouthpiece of these Australian Nazi enthusiasts for the remaining 6 years.
Miles, though, was a real anti-Semite, wasn't he?
Miles had been anti-Semitic for some decades. It's a bit hard to pin down his ideology, but he's really against just about everything, including democracy, and very anti-Semitic. Stevenson, there's no particular indication that he was necessarily anti-Semitic before his association with Miles in late 35, mid 36, but he gradually becomes more anti-Semitic, and of course he then assumes the position of Australia's leading anti-Semite. Mm. By 1940 he's writing articles called A Reasoned Case for Anti-Semitism.
Yes, defending Hitler's anti-Semitism.
That's right.
At the time. He was initially critical of Hitler, but soon adopts not only Hitler's views, as you say, but also his look. He has a mustache. He looks remarkably like the Führer.
He does. Apparently his speaking style on the platform was also modelled on Hitler. And there was a dispute between Jack Lindsay and Stevenson about when that toothbrush mustache had been grown. Stevenson later claimed that he'd had it in the 1920s. Jack Lindsay denied it.
Well, Stevenson also came up with the remarkable theory of the Australian origins of the Aryan race. So he was a promoter of the Aryan race, but believed that Australia was the actual birthplace?
Yes, this is perhaps the most strangest aspect of the entire story, that it's a 19th century theory that was revived in the 1930s by a Swiss academic who came to Australia to espouse it. And the argument runs that the Australian Aborigines were in fact the original Aryans. They originated here in Australia and then spread north as far as India. So, according to people like Stevenson, Northern Europeans migrating to Australia, he argues, are returning home, and Australia is the cradle of the Aryan race. Therefore, they want to incorporate Aboriginal spirituality and dreaming, as they call it, into a white dream time, as they also call it. Now, you can imagine this was regarded as an extraordinary view in the 1930s by mainstream white Australians, who, of course, were still remain convinced, I suppose, that the Aborigines were dying out. But Stevenson and then a group of the literary followers who have a similar view, the Jindy Warabacks, believe that Australia can only find its own identity by incorporating Aboriginal spirituality.
Melbourne-based historian David Bird commenting on P.R. Stevenson's theory that the Aboriginal Australians were the original Aryans. I wonder what Stevenson thought of William Cooper, the Aboriginal Australian who led a delegation of the Australian Aboriginal League to the German consulate in Melbourne in 1938, protesting the cruel persecution of the Jewish people by the Nazi government. That would have put a dent in Inky's reasoning. This is Nazi Dreams and Realities on the Spirit of Things here on RN, abc.net.au/radionational. David Bird's book, Nazi Dreamtime, covers a wide array of characters, some of whom are still revered despite, and sometimes because of, their particular beliefs. Something I explored further with David. Well, Inky Stevenson had some interest in paganism, but another personality, Alexander Rudd Mills, the Melbourne solicitor, was a full-blown promoter of Odinism, which had some popularity among the Nazis. Why did he prefer the ancient lore of Northern Europe to Christianity?
Alexander Rudd Mills was always of great interest to me because he originates from the same area of northwestern Tasmania where I was born. And he left the island fairly soon, was a teacher, got into trouble with the education department, left, eventually drifted to Melbourne and entered the Melbourne University Law School, where he was a friend of Robert Menzies, lifelong friend of Robert Menzies. And he claimed in 1954, he wrote a letter to Stevenson reviewing his worldview, you might say, and he said that for 40 years he'd been aware that Christianity was a poisonous philosophy because of its Jewish influence. And some of these Nazi enthusiasts agreed with him and said, well, what we should do is remove the Jewish element from Christianity and we can have an Aryan form of Christianity. Sometimes they referred to it as positive Christianity. But Mills wants to throw the baby out with the bathwater. He wants to remove Christianity from Western thought and influence and replace it with Odinism. Now, this is the religion of ancient Northern Europe, long since extinct, of course. And he believes that it will bring with it a new system of ethics, inequality, anti-democratic, anti-Jewish, heroic, all that sort of idea.
Sounds like Nietzsche.
It's clearly influenced by Nietzscheanism. Now, Mills even went to Germany in the early 30s and sought an interview with, and gained an interview with Hitler in 1932 before Hitler was Chancellor in Munich. He tried to influence Hitler in these ideas. Now, Hitler, of course, was very familiar with this stream of thought that Christianity should be eliminated, not just de-Judaized, but eliminated, and he'd rejected that idea. General Ludendorff, one of Hitler's early patrons, was a great champion of this idea of reviving Odinism, and Mill said that he spoke to Hitler about it, but he couldn't interest him in his topic. And in Mein Kampf, there's actually a section where Hitler ridicules these people as who run around with horned helmets and shields and swords and so on.
Yes, I think the German alternative was the German faith movement, was a de-Judaized Christianity.
Now, Stevenson seems to he's of Danish extraction, and he claimed that he had an interest in Odinism, but he doesn't really take, certainly doesn't take it as far as Mills. Mills, in fact, was quite fanatical about this in his writings throughout the 1930s and even into the post-war period. He has become something of a champion amongst a movement that's post-war movement known as esoteric Nazism. And in fact, strangely enough, there was a circle at Melbourne University up until very recently, about 2 years ago, they had a website called the Odinic Right of Australia movement, and apparently they, whether they still do, I don't know, but apparently they would gather on an annual basis at Alexander Rudd Mill's grave in the Dandenongs and perform some sort of Odinic ritual there.
Oh my goodness. Well, Mills didn't shy away from using Nazi paraphernalia, donning the big gold swastika on his publication.
There was certainly no ambiguity about where he stood on the movement in Germany. Certainly a follower of the Hitler cult. The only thing he differs with Stevenson and people like Miles is that he's not so inclined to view Nazism as a political movement. He rather sees it almost as the harbinger of a new religion, and that new religion includes the Hitler cult.
Well, perhaps the most intriguing personality amongst the many who populate your book is the architect William Hardy Wilson. Some of his well-known houses were built in the suburbs of Sydney, in Gordon, Pymble and Warunga. What drove Hardy Wilson to this Nazi dreaming?
William Hardy Wilson is a very strange figure, as you say, a very noted architect, and once again, as I sort of have a little cross current with Alexander Rudd Mills, I discovered after I'd written the book that I'd actually lived in a house in Tasmania that William Hardy Wilson had drawn in his great work of 1924, Colonial Architecture in New South Wales and Tasmania. Now, he's very much an aesthete, an elitist, not especially anti-Semitic in his youth, but in fact quite a fan of the idea that Australia can become a melting place of Oriental and European culture, not necessarily of race, though. So he's a bit ahead of his time there. But by the 1920s, he's looking for alternatives, like many of these people. He rejects Bolshevism, and he looks towards Mussolini's Italy as some sort of harbinger of a new aesthetic movement in Europe, writes letters to Mussolini praising him and so on. In the course of the 1930s, he drifts towards anti-Semitism, condemns Jews as non-creative, as parasites, and that, of course, leads him, obviously, towards Nazism. He's not a political figure. He never joins the Australia First movement, but he's clearly associated with people like Stevenson and Mills and Miles, and he's writing letters to Hitler praising him for the cultural progress that's being made in the Third Reich and for their program of controlling Judaism. By 1941, these people are paranoid about that. They're looking forward to a German victory in the World War. The only thing that worries them about that is the fact that Germans will then expel hundreds of thousands, millions of Jews from Europe. Where will they go? And, of course, the great fear of these people is that they'll come to Australia. So William Hardy Wilson spends part of his time in his retirement constructing plans for concentration camps in the Dandenongs with watchtowers on various mountains. But he spent quite a few years in the 1930s in self-imposed exile in Tasmania because he believed that Tasmanians were of a purer racial stock than their mainland cousins. And he wants to awaken Tasmanians to the coming racial threat from Asia, despite the fact that he's actually very much in favour of Chinese culture and architecture.
Chinese or Japanese?
Both. It's originally Chinese, then he becomes very much disposed towards Japanese culture, but then returns towards the Chinese side by the 1940s and in the post-war period. Now, the most interesting aspect of William Hardy Wilson's career, though, is his successful application to be the director of the National Gallery of Victoria in 1936. He'd come back from self-imposed exile in Tasmania as a gentleman farmer. He was very well off financially, so he didn't really need employment, but he applied for the directorship of the National Gallery of Victoria, was successful, 7 votes to 5, apparently, amongst the trustees. But unfortunately, a friend of Keith Murdoch, and he gave an interview after he'd received a letter telling him that he'd been successful. He gave an interview to the Melbourne Herald in which he stated his clear intention of removing degenerate art from the National Gallery of Victoria and removing Jewish influence from the Australian art movement. Well, when the Victorian Cabinet met on the following Monday to confirm this appointment, they decided that it wasn't such a good one after all, and they overturned it. And William Hardy Wilson spent the rest of his life condemning the Jews for having overturned him from this particular position.
Well, that's pretty predictable, isn't it? That kind of reaction. I mean, these people believed the Jews controlled everything, so whenever they encountered problems in their life in one way or another, there was always a Jew somewhere behind it all.
Hardy Wilson's writing letters to Hitler in 1940 saying, look, you know, what you're doing in Europe is the right path. The Jews control Australia. We need to do the same thing.
Well, people like Wilson and Mills, Miles and Stevenson, not to mention Eric Campbell, all believed that the Jews were behind everything, echoing the Nazi propaganda and the publications like the Protocols of the Elders of Zion also circulated and read amongst these people. So presumably they weren't repentant when the full-blown nature of Hitler's Holocaust was revealed after the war. Or did any of these characters change their views?
These people were left relatively unmolested after the outbreak of war on September 39, strangely enough, despite what they were saying. They were still praising Germany and still they see Hitler as a rival, not an enemy. They're left unmolested until after Pearl Harbor and the invasion scare of February 42, the bombing of Darwin and things like that. Then their leadership is arrested and they disappear for a couple of years. Most of them are released after about 6 months, but some of them are there for the duration, like Stevenson. Now, after the war, some of these guys disappear. The leading street agitator amongst them, a guy called Leslie Cahill, becomes a football coach. He abandons politics. But most of them continue with the propaganda that they were known for in the 1930s. Mills, as I say, Mills really comes into his own as the champion of esoteric Nazism in the post-war period. Stevenson continually contemplates the idea of re-entering politics and re-establishing the publicist, but he never quite gets around to it. He becomes a freelance writer. But he becomes even more doggedly right-wing and anti-Semitic in the 1950s and early 60s than he was in the 1930s. He's writing letters in the 1950s, ending them with Sieg Heil and Hitler was right and all this sort of thing. And he believes that the entire world now is absolutely controlled by the Jews. So he's quite unrepentant.
Gosh. Well, David, I was fascinated by your book, as I said at the beginning, and there's so much in it. Thank you so much for being on The Spirit of Things. It's a great insight into this rather shameful layer or period in the history of Australia.
My pleasure, Rachel.
Melbourne-based historian David Bird has written Nazi Dreamtime, Australian Enthusiasts for Hitler's Germany. The music you're hearing is by the Jewish composer Isaac Nathan, born 1790, dubbed the father of Australian music. Among other things, he was the first to research and transcribe Indigenous Australian music. That's our program on this anniversary of the defeat of Germany marking the end of the Great War, November 11th, 1918, and also of Kristallnacht, the first major pogrom against the Jews in Germany, November 8th, 1938. Download the audio at our website at abc.net.au/radionational and scroll down to the program. And if you'd like to follow my Twitter feed, you can find me at Spirit of Things. Next week, we find out if the West is going to hell in a haybasket due to secular fundamentalism and the demise of the Judeo-Christian ethic. Decide for yourself on The Spirit of Things right here on RN with me, Rachel Conn.